I work at Columbia, NYU, and UCLA. I frequently travel, domestically and internationally where I'm presenting things. I'm a public speaker as well, so I'm presenting in front of thousands of people, and it's like the first thing you're gonna do is look down at your teeth, look at your appearance to see, do you fit the bill? And I know it sucks because you can't really judge a book by its cover, but I mean, the least you can do is just look good. Even if you're not really saying much of, of substance, at least you can look good, and you look presentable to the audience as well. I was featured on a Forbes article, and it was a topic regarding higher education and whether or not there's diverse, there's diversity in conservative industries like higher education, banking, finance, and things of that sort. And I was reading the comments, and one of the commentators said, "Oh, it must be easy for him to say that, there was not much diversity, there's not much inclusion, because he's a member of a whole lot of a whole slew of prominent organizations, the Grammar Recording Academy. He has done TED Talks. He teaches at Columbia University, so he must have a silver spoon in his mouth." And it was basically he was put in that position to, to succeed. And I'm like, nah, that's not even the case. But when I look at the when I look at the comments, I'm like, that's far from the truth. So I wrote the perfect rejection resume.
Completing your doctorate degree at the age of 24 is a remarkable accomplishment. Could you tell us more about the challenges you faced while pursuing such an advanced degree at a relatively young age and how you overcame them? As a contributor to media outlets like TEDx, Entrepreneur Magazine, Black Enterprise, you've had the opportunity to share your insight with a wide audience. How do you approach conveying complex concepts in a relatable and understandable manner for a broader audience? So I know you were on the cover of Forbes magazine, right?
At this recording, I would say that I do have a good network there at Forbes. I won't say much regarding the, the future implications that I have with the publication, but I will say this. Yes, that picture that you see there, it's real.
And on Instagram, you have, hold on 1 second. You have 441,000 followers. So if that many people like his content, I'm sure y'all gonna love it. 'Cause like I said, he's everywhere. People love him and he's always going viral.
You're up, you're ready, and you're listening to the Brittany Mac podcast. Everyone has a story, applying them to inspire the world weekly on Motivation Mondays. Here's your host, Brittany Mac.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Brittany Mac podcast. Today we have Eli. Welcome to the Brittany Make podcast, Eli.
Thank you for having me, Brittany. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Monday's my favorite day. Monday is my favorite day of the week.
Oh, really? So why do you like Monday?
Fresh start is the first day of the work week. I tend to get most of my work done on Mondays. And on top of that, I'm not sure if you can agree, but I'll say this. Monday is, in my opinion, the fastest day of the week.
Mondays do go by fast. Some people say that Mondays go by extremely slow because a lot of people dread Mondays, but I have so much to do on Mondays to where it goes by extremely fast. So I feel that way too.
Yeah, Monday is my, I think Monday is my favorite day. Then you can count your Friday or you can count that, but Monday is my favorite day of the week.
Yeah, okay, I can see because you're very accomplished, and I feel like that's also something a hard worker would say. Because I feel like you love the work, period.
I do. Yeah, I do. I do.
So, your journey is quite impressive from being a student athlete to achieving multiple degrees and becoming a successful educator, author, and partner. a partner at Quest Diagnostics. How did your experience as a dual student athlete shape your approach to academics and your professional life?
Well, I think as a dual athlete, it's important for, and I'm pretty sure there are listeners that are student athletes as well, I think discipline, being able to follow along a certain schedule or a certain work schedule, just the discipline behind it, the preparation for either a basketball game, a football game, or even a track meet. I was, by the way, when I was in school, I played basketball and I ran track. So it was, you know, basically just practice, and then you have strength and conditioning. You also have your training sessions, your, you know, film sessions as well, preparing for the next game or looking at the past mistakes that I've made or the past mistakes that the team made as well, but also making corrections in practice in order for us to follow through in a game. Same thing as track, like understanding your times, practicing, and it's a reiterated process. So as it translates to everyday work, and even in academia, it's understanding, like, you have a goal set in place, you have objectives, you always want to be successful, but at the same time, you have to prepare. And proper preparation prevents poor performance. So if you are, you know, if you are giving it your all when no one is looking, then it's going to be effortless by the time everyone is looking at you and you have a TED talk or you have a lecture to present. Or if you're doing some work that everyone is paying attention to, then you know that everything is just routine for you.
Right. You had a media appearance. Was that TV?
Yeah.
Let's see. That's the Morning Blend?
Yeah, the Morning Blend, yeah.
Okay, so what is the Morning Blend? Is it like a talk show or something?
I believe it's a talk show. It's similar to, I think it's more so of a, it's similar to the Good Morning America, but it's more so of an introspective type of film. I think they are based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. That was about over a year ago. Mm-hmm. I've had similar TV appearances on PBS with the Whitney Reno show, where it's like a conversation. It's like a conversation like this, but it's like a TV version of a podcast where you're explaining like your journey and understanding. And in my opinion, I love these type of content because I can share my thoughts in real time. And there is no retakes because everything is live. Everything is live and everything is cut and recorded. But at the same time, like there is no room for error. There's no room for mistakes as well. So you got to bring it. You got to bring it on. So the Morning Blend it's similar to that of like the Whitney Renner show or even the bigger platforms like Good Morning America and, you know, other platforms of that sort, or even The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, I mentioned that because I noticed that you have such a TV smile. Because, you know, like TV, they like to look at your teeth and you just have, you know how Steve Harvey has that grand TV smile? That's something I never noticed until now doing this interview. And I'm like, oh my gosh, where did that come from? And I immediately thought about your TV appearance. And I was like, yeah, I can see he got the TV look.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, that's one of those like unspoken rules, or it's one of those requirements that it's a nice to have. It's a nice to have requirement. No, not saying that you got to come, you know, like this, or you got to have like a brilliant smile, but it's more so of a nice to have because what goes on, like when you have things that are recorded and when things are put out there, that's it. There's no turning back. You can't even ask the producers to take it down because it's too late. Millions of people have already seen it already, or even thousands of people have already seen it. So you can't really, like, the least that I can do is look good. But even if I'm sitting here throughout the simulcast, I'm smiling. I mean, I can go viral, but you can't say nothing wrong with my appearance or my smile. So that's the least that I can do. And I think it's also important when it comes to like lecturing, and I'm presenting. I work at Columbia, NYU, and UCLA. I frequently travel you know, domestically and internationally, where I'm presenting things. I'm a public speaker as well. So I'm presenting in front of thousands of people. And it's like, the first thing you're going to do is look down at your teeth, look at your appearance to see, you know, do you fit the bill? And I know it sucks mm-hmm. because you can't really judge a book by its cover, but I mean, the least you can do is just look good. Even if you're not really saying much of, you know, of substance, at least you can look good and you look presentable to the audience as well.
Right. Yep. You're absolutely right. Your book, The Perfect Rejection Resume, could you share with your listeners what inspired you to write this book and what key concepts can they expect to find within these pages?
So the genesis of writing this book, it came from the comments, believe it or not, of people that were commenting on or providing sentiment towards my work. So I believe back in 2020, I was featured on a Forbes article, and it was a topic regarding higher education and whether or not there's diverse, you know, there's diversity in conservative industries like higher education, banking, finance, and things of that sort. And I was reading the comments, and one of the commentators said, "Oh, it must be easy for him to say that, you know, that, you know, there was not much diversity, there's not much inclusion, because he's a member of a whole slew of you know, prominent organizations, the Grammar Recording Academy. He has done TED Talks. He teaches at Columbia University. So he must have a silver spoon in his mouth." And it was basically, he was put in that position to, you know, to succeed. And I'm like, nah, that's not even the case. But when I look at the comments, I'm like, that's far from the truth. So I wrote The Perfect Rejection Resume. And the reason why I came up with the title, The Perfect Rejection Resume, is that rejection and failure is never perfect, but it perfectly fits within your story. So when I was writing the book, I was coming up with concepts. I was coming up with key ideas and concepts that I think readers can not only relate to, but can also apply in their everyday life. So one of the concepts that I've applied, that I've actually put in the book, and I actually encourage readers to live by, is that rent is due every day. And what do I mean by rent is due every single day is that success is never owned. Like, you can never own your success, as you know, people can say, "Oh, you've succeeded so much and you've accomplished so much." You do realize that you can gain it all today and you can lose it all tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I always look at success as something that you can rent. And as you're releasing your success, you have to understand that you must put in the work in every day, right? So your currency is your effort that you put in, and the rent that you're paying every day is your goals, your objectives. So rent is due every day. That means that whether or not you're going to succeed or not, that succeeding or failure is not really the end goal. And it doesn't really equate to success. Success, in my opinion, is not perfection, but it's more so of a progress. As long as you're progressing, you're succeeding. So that's one of the concepts that I've lived by. As far as rent is due every day, this is why I love Mondays, because Monday is my favorite day of the week, and it's a fresh start. Mm-hmm. Everyone else, mm-hmm. and I would say everyone else, but mostly, you know, everyone in America, or even worldwide, they don't really like Mondays, because it's like, oh gosh, it's a new day, it's a new work week, and I have to go back to work, and I don't like what I'm doing. Uh-huh. I tend to have the opposite of, you know, feelings towards Monday. I love Monday. It's like, I got to do something to stay productive. And that's how I live by. And it translates, and it actually brings in that momentum throughout the whole week. So if I have that attitude, I am succeeding, because as long as I'm progressing, I know that I'm doing well. And I'll share another tidbit as well. In the as we segue into the concept of progression, we have to understand that direction is much more important than speed. And when I mean by that is that you can be the fastest person to accomplish something, right? Mm-hmm. Or even if, like, You know, and everyone wants to be the first person to ever do this, or you hear this all the time. Oh, I'm the first African American person, or I'm the first African American woman to be in this environment, or to succeed something. And that's nice to have. It's nice to approach your goals and your objectives in that regard. However, if you are basically doing things the wrong way, you're going nowhere fast. And this is why direction is much more important than speed. Mm-hmm. It's important to go the right direction rather than going the wrong direction fast. And most people like to do things fast. We live in a day and age where everything needs to be quick, instantaneous, and we need to get everything now. We need to get everything now, and we need to get everything now, or we are left behind and we are a failure. And it's like, what I've done wrong, and I hate my life and whatnot. So direction is much more important than speed is a key concept that we must live by. And it actually adds on to the idea that, you know, renters do it every single day.
Yes, absolutely. Completing your doctorate degree at the age of 24 is a remarkable accomplishment. Could you tell us more about the challenges you faced while pursuing such an advanced degree at a relatively young age and how you overcame them?
So the challenges that I faced while I was at Felicia University, and this is a school that mostly no one knows, it's a school in the middle of nowhere. It's in New Jersey, by the way. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was working on my doctorate, the lack of resources that I had at that institution, and it's not their fault, it's not the administrator's fault, it's just the fact that we didn't have much to work with. But I understood the value of resources in education and basically pulling things by the bootstraps, doing things on your own, DIY. I really enjoyed that experience. Even if, you know, to some students, you know, you like to be guided to success throughout your doctorate program. I was working with my advisor, and we were basically doing things on our own. It was like, all right, we got to do this. And it was not much help, or it was not much assistance. Up until I got at Columbia University, that was towards the third year and my third and final year at my doctorate program. Right before I was slated to write my dissertation and defend it, I got an offer at Columbia University. And even at that time, during that summer of 2018, I was also doing a summer program at the Harvard Business School online. So I was doing both, and I was excited because this is the first time since I started my doctorate program back in 2016 that I was able to get resources outside of, you know, the school, the home school that I was actually working on my doctorate for. So that was my main, that was basically my main issue. And, or not even my main issue, but it's more so of a main constraint that I had while I was working. It was one of the challenges that I had to overcome. And I was so happy that I overcame. And when Dr. Turi mentioned, you know, my name for the first time as Dr. Joseph, I was like, wow, it really hit me at that moment where it's like, wow, it was really, this is it. And one thing that I would like to tell readers, that even if, if you look at my story, you look at all the schools and all the accolades and all the success that I've accumulated, like in the past, and I'm continuing to accumulate now, you may think that, oh my gosh, like I don't go to a R1 high level institution, or I don't work at Goldman Sachs. I don't work at Google or Microsoft. So I can't relate to, you know, your story of success. I would like to say this, that it doesn't matter where you start. It's just a matter of progressing. It's all a matter of making a name for yourself and also being confident. Like, you got to be confident that you can do it. You can do the same work as someone who works at Stanford, or someone who works at Columbia, or someone who works at Google or Amazon or Microsoft, JP Morgan. You can do the same work. Everyone is capable. It's just a matter of where you're allocating your energy to.
Absolutely. So, and it's funny because you've taught me about the imposter syndrome. You was like, you don't believe in it and you should just believe and stuff like that. So That does make a lot of sense. He does.
I mean, I've said this before and I'll say this again. I think imposter syndrome is just, it's an illusion. It's not real. I mean, even when, before I became relevant, and I'll put that in quotation, before I became this, guy, it was more so this confident that, regardless of whether or not I'm in this room, for a reason. And it doesn't matter if you went to Penn Wharton. It doesn't matter if you went to Harvard or Stanford, or it doesn't matter if you have accomplished so much. I deserve to be in the same room as you. We breathe the same air. We bleed the same way. We tie our shoes the same way. We put on our clothes. We shower the same way. We are similar. It's just, the only difference is that, you have a brand that is backing you and you have an institution that's backing you. Or it's same for me. You can say the same for me as well. The only difference is that you have a network, and that's the only difference. And it should not impede your thought of succeeding in the same room as someone who had these type of resources to begin with.
Right. You have an extensive teaching career ranging from Marymount Manhattan College to Columbia University, New York University, and now UCLA Extension. How do you approach teaching in such diverse academic environments, and what do you find most fulfilling about educating students?
I appreciate not only the feedback that I get from students, but I feel like students are relieved when they take my courses, because the majority of the courses that I teach is very demanding. It's technical. I teach stats, I teach econometrics, I teach research process and management, I teach framework courses that incorporates coding, and I teach grad students that are basically in the second year of their grad degree and master's, and they're about to graduate and they have to do a technical course. And I teach those type of classes, the classes that students don't want to take and the classes that professors don't want to teach. So, being in that environment, students come to me with a sense of not only urgency, but also a sense of concern, because it's like, we don't know what to expect. And I appreciate the fact that I'm working with them. And I always harp on the notion that I love to build a plane while I'm flying it. I don't like to teach from textbooks. I never, besides my first ever gig at Marymount Manhattan College, where I had to teach from a textbook, because I was actually subbing in for another professor who got injured during a snowstorm, and I had to fill in. So obviously I had to follow a textbook and I had to follow a certain rubric and that the professor at the time was following. But besides that, when I had my courses, when I was holding my courses, it was just strictly improvisation, building a plane while you're flying it, coding on the fly, making mistakes, and also showing students that I can make mistakes as well and I can be corrected as well. And it's also interactive, it's engaging as well. And I always love that. I always love those type of environments where students are free and liberated to do things and not be afraid to mess up. And that's what I love. I love the feedback from the students whenever at the end of the course is like, oh my gosh, I enjoyed this course. I thought I was going to fail to begin with, and I didn't know what to expect, but I'm so happy that I enrolled in your course, because not only have I learned the material, but at the same time, I feel confident in the skill sets that I obtained, and also in applying it in the real world as well. So I always love the feedback and the application, and it basically helps me realize that I'm actually doing a work and I have a purpose beyond just teaching. And also it helps that, whenever I get feedback from the students and, they graduate on, they tend to ask for recommendations. And I found out that they're pursuing a PhD at Harvard, or they're pursuing a PhD at Dartmouth or, Princeton. It's like, oh my gosh, you guys came a long way and you guys were scared. You guys were scared taking my course, and now look at what you guys are doing. You guys are accomplishing a lot. It always makes me proud that, the students can transition into consulting and into finance and tech and various other industries where they're making a key impact. And I always love that the full revolution of just a student who's scared and who's timid into someone who's confident and who's graduating with confidence, and also being able to conquer the world, and you know, seeing them at work as well. So I always encourage, you know, students to move forward. But I think it's just the transitioning between, you know, getting students to get out of their shell and getting comfortable into you know, using their skill sets wisely, and basically making the most of what they have.
Yes, I feel like your students can come to you about anything. And I think I think that's what definitely helps along with that.
And I love, you know, it's also, you know, having this good environment that allows students to confide in you as well. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's not only about doing research, or it's not only about, you know, teaching a course and saying, all right, you guys are dismissed and good luck with your future endeavors, because you never know. You never know, you know, for example, if you take Barack Obama and you say that, you know, and if I was teaching him at Occidental College before transferring into Columbia, I'll be proud, you know, to say that I taught a future president. You never know who your students might become in the future. So I always have this welcoming type of demeanor. Mm-hmm. And it's a disposition to have, because it allows, you know, students to be comfortable. And once again, you never know what they might become in the future.
Right. So I know you were on the cover of Forbes magazine, right?
Yeah, somewhat. So that cover that it's been released, it's more so of a cover that has been derived from the summit that I've attended in 2018. I would say this, at this recording, I would say that I do have a good network there at Forbes. Mm-hmm. I won't say much regarding the, you know, the future implications that I have with the publication, but I will say this. Yes, that picture that you see there, it's real, but at the same time, it was derived from the Forbes Under 30 Summit in 2018. But we shall see what comes up in the future. So that's all I have to say for now. But it's true. I was on that cover.
Okay. We're going to be watching. We're seeing you as a contributor to media outlets like TEDx, Entrepreneur Magazine, Black Enterprise. You've had the opportunity to share your insight with a wide audience. How do you approach conveying complex concepts in a relatable and understandable manner for a broader audience?
So I do that by making complex you know, issues or even complex concepts simple and applicable in the real world. So whenever I get a piece, or whenever I have an idea that is commissioned by certain publications like the World Economic Forum that I work with recently, and I have published a lot of material for the World Economic Forum, or even Inc. Magazine or the Harvard Business Review, I come to this, I have this system that I work with, where we have this complex idea, like, for example, skill elasticity, right? The elasticity of the demand for skills, right? So in economics, we know that elasticity is basically how we respond to the change in demand, we respond to the change in resources, whether it's price, income, and in this case, skill. When I come into a situation where I have this piece that I'm writing and it's commissioned by the World Economic Forum, I have to not only define what it means to have, you know, to be in demand for skills, but also provide ideas and provide some insights to, you know, to help readers and professionals apply what they understand of skill elasticity in real life, in real term, and in real time actually. So I come with an idea that is complex, and I'm basically writing it into simple terms so that way everyone can understand the material and everyone feel included as well. And not only that, they can engage with my idea as well. I recently published an article regarding failure, right? How to overcome failure and how to use failure as your advantage, as an advantage in the future. And I don't dumb things down, but I make things simple, where it's like, okay, in order for you to overcome failure, first off, you have to document your failures. You have to document it. And in my case, I have the rejection resume, but in your case, it can be a rejection, a resume of failures, right? A CV of failures where you're writing down all of the mishaps that you have encountered in your life, all the important mishaps, whether you have been rejected by your dream school, or you have been demoted from your dream job, or you didn't get the offer that you wanted to get. You write it down, you document that. And in order for you to document that, you feel more comfortable and you feel more confident in tackling the issues that may have led to the demise, or that may have led to your mishaps from, these failures here. And then from that point, you progress, and you never know, you might revisit the opportunities that you had in the past, that you failed in the past. And then now that you understand what you have done in the past, perhaps you may have a better luck this time because you're prepared. So, I think when it comes to contributing for other outlets, it's basically making things simple and providing applications to help them move further.
Your contributions to various renowned publications, including Forbes Incorporated Magazine and Harvard Business Review, are quite impressive. Could you share some insights into how you balance your teaching, research, and writing endeavors, and how these different aspects of your career complement each other?
Great question. Wow, great question. So, as you may know, I have a lot of things going on. And how I break things down by days and by objectives. So, for example, today, I know that today I have an interview with you, and so I block out that time, right? But I have another article that I'm writing for within the World Economic Forum that I'm publishing it, and that's basically beyond the idea of the shifters of demand, of skills demand as well. So I have an article that I'm writing. I know that I can write this article. If it takes me about an hour to sit down and write the majority of the article, I'll be able to finish by tonight. Speaking of tonight, I don't really sleep. I don't really sleep much. And that's something I'm working on. That's a work in progress for me. I sleep about 4 to 6 hours in a given day or a given night. Sometimes I don't sleep at all. So it depends on the workload that I have in a given day. So I can sleep like a baby for 7 hours if I don't have nothing in my plate for the night before or even the day after. But that's not really realistic because I'm either teaching or I'm either doing cases as a partner at Quest, or I'm either writing articles, or I'm doing meetings. I'm doing a lot of things at once. So I just try to break things down by objectives. And this basically harps on to the next concept that I have in this book and the Perfect Rejection Resume, the concept of time. And I always harp on the fact that we're always competing against time. And that was actually my TED talk, one of my TEDx talk that I did in Queens Village was time is your greatest competition. And I broke it down where from the start, from the time that we're waking up, right, we have an alarm clock. And that alarm clock that we have to fight against, that's basically the beginning of the battle against time, right? We are in competition with time. We don't even know it. So we are, we wake up, we have to snooze the alarm, or we have to wake up to, in response to the alarm, and then we have to get our day started. But that's just the beginning. What happens when we have deadlines? We're working against a deadline, right? So that's another thing that we have to look into, right? We have deadlines that we must abide by. And then we also have responses and stresses that we accumulate in response to the deadlines, right? So in the beginning, when we have a deadline set, let's say we have a deadline for a project that needs to be done 6 months from now. At this point, we're relaxed. At this point, we are working towards our deadlines within 6 months. But if we have, if we're 5 months in and we don't have much work done, then we are stressed out. We are operating in a form of distress because we have 1 month left. And on top of that, we don't have much time to idle. We don't have much time to play around. So we were constantly fighting against time. And I always have this, if we incorporate the previous concepts of rent is doing it every day, and direction is much more important than speed, and on top of that, you add on time being our greatest competition. We're basically competing against time every single day, and we're putting forth that effort. And this is how I basically multitask, and I can teach, I can do podcast interviews, I can do television interviews as well, I can write articles, and I can do caseloads, and I can still operate in a sense of sanity every single day and have some rest as well, because I operate in that time frame where I'm constantly competing against time. And I hope that can help our listeners not only manage time well, but also understand that, once again, time is due, rent is due every day. You're operating at a positive direction, and also you're competing against time and you're winning. So that's basically how I juggle everything at once and multitask.
Absolutely. Your story is one of determination and success. I mean, hey, you make history and you go by all the time for it. You're doing so good. But what advice would you give to young, inspiring individuals who are juggling multiple passions and ambitions, hoping to follow a similar path of accomplishment?
So the advice that I'll give, and it sounds cliche, and I hate to say this, but I hate to say it in this way, but don't be afraid to fail. I built my brand based off of failure, right? Based off of that one comment, I built my brand off of failure. So even if I try something risky and I fail, so what? I can share my failures, right? And everyone loves a good comeback story. So that can be the beginning, right? So even if you get rejected and you failed at something that you wanted to accomplish, that's the beginning of your story. But when that table's turned and you go viral and your table's turned and everyone is praising you, everyone is giving you flowers, just understand that it started and it cultivated from the original element of failure. So I tell people all the time, don't be afraid to fail. Why are you scared to try something new? Why are you scared to try something risky? Why are you like, what's the worst thing that can possibly happen? Right. What's the worst possible thing that you can possibly endure? You can get a no, or okay, you can get your feelings hurt. You can cry today. But then again, what happens from there? Like, what are you going to do about it? So I always have this mindset of like just trying things and always sharing I always share my stories. And even if you follow me on Instagram, it's like, you know, my IG stories are always, you know, engaging. It's like, it's risky, but at the same time, there's reward that comes with that risk. And if you can cultivate your story from failure, and you can cultivate that from, you know, trials and tribulations, then, you know, the sky's the limit. So let's say you try something, you fail, right? Cool. Mm-hmm. You can share that story. So that way you can give that impression that nothing is easy. But the next time you succeed, everyone's congratulating you. But at the same time, you can always come back to that original point where it's like, it was never easy to begin with. And you can always appreciate that progress. So the number one advice that I would tell people is just to never waver from, you know, trying things that you know is risky. But at the same time, don't be afraid to fail. Just try it. Give it a shot. And you never know. You never know what will happen in the future.
Right. In today's rapidly changing world, what role do you see education playing in shaping the future? And how can individuals best prepare themselves for the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead?
So if we're operating in a world of economic uncertainty, I'll say this. Prompt engineering, this is your ChatGPT, this is your deep learning, this is your machine learning elements here. That is going to be the most, if it hasn't already, it's going to be the most prominent skill set, or even a prominent direction that we're going towards. ChatGPT, machine learning, deep learning, automation, artificial intelligence, big data. Those are like, without question, that is the key driver of, or the key catalyst of, like, you know, like economics moving forward. And what happens when we have a drastic change where everything is being automated now, and every business and everyone is basically relying on technology, you realize that certain skill sets will be obsolete, right? Certain skill sets, whether it's, you know, basically things regarding, you know, manual work, it's still necessary, but it's not as necessary as it was back then. And if we understand that we have trends and we have things that we have to look out for within the world of problem engineering, it also breeds the level of like ingenuity and innovation as well. So that's basically the key driver of like our economy now, just prompt engineering and big tech, big data. That's where we're basically moving forward to.
Yes. Could you share a glimpse into any upcoming projects, research, or endeavors you're currently working on or excited about?
All right, I'll share it. I'm currently working on a course that I'm curating. Actually, not one course, but four courses that I'm curating. And it's a possibility that I will be teaching these courses at Stanford and Dartmouth. So Stanford University, Dartmouth College, shout out to you guys. It's a possibility that I'll be working with them for a couple throughout the duration of the academic year, where I'm curating courses in various topics such as prompt engineering. You have your applied analytics, project management, and also time management as well. So I'm basically hearing, I'm getting some feedback, and we shall see what happens as I get response and I get word back from the curriculum for both universities. I'll definitely share those type of news, exciting news, with the public, but we shall see. But I'm currently working on these courses right now.
Okay. Given your impressive journey and the many achievements you've amassed, from academia to your roles at Quest Diagnostics and media contributions, could you share with us a moment or an experience that you're particularly grateful for? And how has practicing gratitude influenced your outlook on success and personal growth?
One situation that I'll circle back to the tumultuous time that I was experiencing in Queens College. So when I was pursuing my bachelor's degree in mathematics, I remember failing two courses in mathematics. I was a major in mathematics. And I failed two courses in linear algebra and statistics, which is ironic because I'm teaching similar courses now. So I failed those courses, and I had a meeting with my advisor, Dr. Martin Braun. And he told me, he said, look, you failed two courses. You're basically facing academic probation. You have transferred before. You transferred your courses from Siena College, which is the first institution that I attended at the time. And he said, look, it's either you will graduate now, or you will leave with a degree like the next following semester, which is the spring of 2015, or you will be dismissed by the university at Queens College. So it was either one or the other. It's either you leave with something or you get expelled because of the academic probation, and you have the provisions and the guidelines with students who are who have a poor GPA. So I had to take, and with his permission and various other, you know, with the provost permission as well, I had to take 10 courses in the spring of 2015. So I was 30 credits in one semester. And those who don't know, when you're attending college, the typical amount of credits that you're taking is about 12 to 15. So that's basically twice as much of course loads that you're taking in one semester. And the reason why I had to take that amount of credits or that amount of classes in one semester is because I had to graduate. And I was only, at the time, I passed the sophomore mark. The second year, I was on the upper second year threshold. So I had to take a good amount of classes in one semester in order for me to graduate. And that taught me a few things here. One of the major takeaways that I got from that experience is that, number one, you have to have people that are back in your corner. So there's a difference between your advisor, who at the time, Dr. Martin Braun served as my advisor, but you have mentors who at the time, I really didn't have no mentors, but I had a sponsor. I had a few sponsors at the time. So you have advisors, mentors, and sponsors. Your advisor are the people that you can talk to every day that can offer you advice, right? That's something that you can have a multitude of advisors, and that's not a problem to have. It's actually important to have advisors, but at the same time, you have your mentors. These are the people that are willing to coach you through the process. And these are the people that are willing to talk to you while you are in the room. I had sponsors and I had advisors. And sponsors are basically the people that are willing to advocate for you on your behalf when you are not in the room. These are the people that are willing to vouch for you when you are not in the room. And these are people that are willing to push buttons behind closed doors so that way you are able to accomplish something. And I had that in Wallace Goldberg. I had that in my provost. I had that with the people that were willing to sign off and give me permission to take that many credits, despite failing two classes prior and having a poor GPA. And with these sign-offs, it enabled me to take these courses, and I was able to pass all my classes and graduate in early. I was able to graduate early when I was just 20 years old. I don't take that experience for granted, because that was basically the beginning of the success moving forward in academia.
All right. Well, I am so happy that I got to close this season out with you. I really wanted to close it out with you, and we made it happen. And I would like to know, so what do you think about the theme of this season? What do you think about season 3, Grateful?
Grateful. It's just when you basically culminate a ton of stories together, right? And it has a commonality of perseverance, and I have a commonality of like overcoming failure, overcoming tragedy, overcoming trauma. The theme of grateful and being grateful, it allows us as not only speakers, but also as presenters to the public to, gravitate towards and also hone in on certain stories that the listeners can understand. The listeners can second with or can appreciate and also be grateful for their experiences as well. And it's also a reminder. It's a reminder that nothing is easy. Nothing is ever easy. But at the same time, you can't take things for granted. And that's what being grateful is all about, right? Not taking things for granted, not discounting our story, discounting our pathway to success, or not being able to relish in the rubbish, relish in the tribulations and the turbulence that we may encounter in our day-to-day lives. And being grateful encompasses that, the idea of not taking things for granted, and being able to appreciate the opportunity of waking up every single day, because just the mere fact that we were able to wake up today and do what we were doing, we have to be grateful for that. And if as we close this season out, and as you provide and develop this idea, this barrage of stories from all people from all walks of life, you realize that the commonality of overcoming trauma, overcoming things, and being able to overcome failure and being successful throughout the tribulations, it makes the season worthwhile. And I'm pretty sure the listeners will appreciate this the season as well.
Thank you so much. And I have some news that I wanted to release during this episode. Now Brittany Mack is a registered trademark.
Okay. Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. We got a monopoly on my name. But yeah, I wanted to.
I can't use Brittany Mac anywhere. I have to pay you to basically use your likeness and everything like that, or
we can license it out. You know, we can figure something out. We can partner, you know. But yeah,
congratulations.
Thank you so much. But yeah, I really enjoyed you. Is there anything else you want to tell your listeners, anywhere you want them to find you or anything they can look forward to?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, all social media platforms. I like to keep my username uniform and it's the same. So Drelijoseph.Drelijoseph, Drelijoseph with no periods or no underscores. So you can find me on all platforms as well. The book, The Perfect Rejection Resume, is also available on all platforms. Amazon, you have your Barnes & Nobles, Walmart. You can purchase the book everywhere. It's available as well. It's also available via ebook as well. So that's that. I look forward to connecting with the listeners here. If they want to follow me or connect with me on LinkedIn, feel free to do so. Or if you want to just simply read my articles and read my pieces, you can easily do that on my platform, my social media platforms, or even my website as well.
Right. And on Instagram, you have 441,000 followers. So if that many people like his content, I'm sure y'all gonna love it, because like I said, he's everywhere. People love him and he's always going viral. It's crazy. And we didn't even touch on everything that you've done. That's just how impressive that you've been. But just seeing the things that we've talked about, people can already see just, you know, how impressive your journey is, and just I'm sure your future as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think what a key testament to like having a huge following, having a good brand, is just it's how you convey your message. And a lot of people, and as influencers, they're telling people what to do, right? They're always constantly saying, hey, here's what you should do. Here's what you should do. And, you know, they're trying to offer that type of advice. In my regard, or in my case, it's like, hey, come with me. Let's take a walk. Let's take a walk and we'll discuss what goes on. And we can have this engaging conversation where we're going back and forth. So whenever I get feedback from my supporters, is like, oh yeah, you inspire me. It's like, yeah, because I'm taking you with me. I'm taking you with me along my journey. And that's what's important. That's the lasting journey. That's also a lasting message for the people that are into social media and branding as well.
Yes. And I'm taking your advice. Okay. Come on. I'm soaking it all in. Well, thank you so much for listening to the Brittany Mac podcast. And thank you so much for listening to season 3. That's a wrap. And I'll let y'all know what's to come next.
Thank you so much for having me, Brittany.
Thank you.